Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The opioid epidemic has rocked families across the country. One Dublin, Ohio mother wrote about her own family struggle with her son's addiction for the online publication Third Rail Politics. Lori Elsass's story not only raised awareness about how addiction affected an unsuspecting middle-class family, but also exposed the broken relationship, or the largely broken relationship, between addiction rehabilitation efforts and public education. Elsass was inspired to start the process of founding a so-called sober school. She's not alone. Several states have changed how they manage teen drug addiction and prevention at the school level. Joining us by phone from School of Social Work at the University of Texas at Austin is Professor Lori Halloran-Steiker. She's co-founder of University High School, Austin's first recovery high school, and the author of a new book entitled Youth and Substance Abuse, Prevention, Intervention, and Recovery. Professor Halloran-Steiker, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Ann. I'm delighted to talk about this.
Today, it's estimated that 1.3 million youths between 12 and 17 have a substance abuse disorder. How does this compare even to, say, 10 or maybe even 5 years ago?
It's very hard to say. I think that there's been waxing and waning with different substances, and we've been very successful in prevention efforts getting the message about alcohol across. So there's been some evening out of alcohol use, except, of course, when once people hit college campuses, then the norms shift. But the use of prescription drugs and opioids has escalated, and the age of onset for that type of use becomes younger and younger every year.
Is how they get addicted an issue, a factor in the equation when it comes to treating it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's really, really important to note that some youth will have a predisposition for substance use disorders by virtue of a disrupted pleasure pathway in the brain. There'll be others that use more from social angles and as a coping mechanism that may not have the brain chemistry. Either way, when we see this happening at a very, very young age, the use of substances sort of hijacks a young person's ability to have healthy coping mechanisms, build healthy relationships, problem solve, have the social skills necessary to be successful in life. So while we do know a lot more about the whys and wherefores, we focus more on helping individual youth to recognize if they're utilizing substances in a way that's problematic.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about youth opioid addiction, particularly, and addiction in general, and how we're responding to that problem at the school level. My guest right now, Lori Halloran-Steiker. She's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin School of Social Work. She's the author of a new book entitled Youth and Substance Use, Substance Abuse, Prevention, Intervention, and Recovery.
If you have Ann, we do say substance use.
Oh, it is substance use. Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
It gives me an opportunity to just speak on the subject of language. I think we're really moving into a revolution in terms of addiction recovery, shifting from focusing on the train wrecks, the negative stories, the nightmares, to the millions of folks that are in recovery. So we've been reframing the substance abuse term as substance use disorders. So for example, like with eating disorders, you would never say somebody was a food abuser. It conjures up all kinds of negativity. So I'm glad that you mentioned it, and I think it's good for people to know.
Okay, good. About half of kids who go into rehab and then return to normal everyday life, school and so forth, about half of them relapse within a year.
There's actually some more conservative studies that show as high as there's one study that shows 67% and one shows 90%, and some at shorter periods of time, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. So
is that about what it is for the adult population as well, or can you be compare and contrast for a second here?
Well, there's no environment that's quite as much of a petri dish for substance use as schools. I mean, especially in the developmental stage of adolescence, okay, where youth are shifting from their focus on their parents to their peers. So I believe that it's one of the higher risk factors for this age group.
Okay. And when do you typically start to see substance use and abuse popping up in young people? Is there a typical age, or is it more a function these days because of the opioid crisis of sports, athletes, that kind of a thing?
I think that we do know that experimentation is normative in our day and age and in among youth. There are still youth that choose not to use, but they are in the minority, not to experiment. I think that we've gotten rid of the concept of a gateway drug because really any drug can be a gateway drug if there's availability and amenability to use. Mm-hmm. So it's important to know that that different cultures have different pressures for use and different substances that are available. The age of onset does get younger and younger, as I mentioned earlier. Here in Travis County in Texas, the average age of onset for marijuana use is 14, and we never used to see use that early in life, but that's pretty prominent.
And how does peer pressure factor into teen drug use? I mean, it's almost cliche. Is it worth talking about?
Well, I like the concept of peer influence as opposed to pressure.
Okay.
We rarely see students getting the old, come on, you got to do this. It's the only thing that's cool. In fact, some of the kids that I've done research with have actually said that if they offer somebody a substance and their peer turns it down, they'll very often say, that's cool, and they may even be thinking more for me. But there is definitely this aspect of youth who are really curious about use, who tend to be sensation seekers, maybe have more anxiety in their life, are looking out at different peer groups and finding peer groups that have substance use as part of their milieu more interesting. They're more attracted and curious about those youth. So it's sort of a reciprocal relationship. So, we can't blame who a kid's hanging out with necessarily, because of course they chose who they're hanging out with.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of pressure, point being that maybe someone starts using because they want to fit into a group that they see as using, and whether or not they're asked to or not.
Exactly. And and once they start using, I would say it's some studies say about 1 in 10 kids will have this disrupted pleasure pathway in the brain, where their brain doesn't process neurotransmitters in the same way, and it becomes a substance use disorder in that they experience the phenomenon of craving. They start to wrap their world around it in much bigger ways, and they may not even be conscious that that is happening.
And meanwhile, back at the ranch, it's illegal. It's not. It's not acceptable by the larger society, so they keep it secret.
That's right.
Have we learned? Well, let's talk bluntly about what the impact of opioids have been on this whole thing. I mean, kids have been doing drugs, since the 60s. There's nothing new about it. But this, what we know about the neurology of it is much more advanced now than it was 40 or 50 years ago. How much of a difference does the opioid crisis play in this?
Well, the scariest thing about opioids, of course, is the possibility of overdose. And we now know that opioid overdose is the number one cause of accidental death, especially in youth. It has surpassed car accidents for 18 to 25-year-olds. So I think the biggest concern is not just that it can really disrupt somebody's healthy development, but that they can die. And we're fortunate that there are drugs like naloxone or Narcan that can be administered. So we're really trying to get the word out nationwide that many, many states have approved legislation that allows for third-party prescriptions for naloxone. Anybody can have it, and it's not dangerous to somebody who might be might have it administered to them if they're not on the substance. It's like water. It won't do anything. But if someone is overdosing, it will bring them out of the overdose quite abruptly, and they can be supported and helped into the next possibility of recovery.
And opioids, again, this is something, particularly the cheaper heroin availability, is a way to have this crisis spread across the country.
Yes.
In all different kinds of neighborhoods, all different kinds of socioeconomic environments.
Yes. I'm glad that you say that, Anne. It's very, very important to recognize that this opioid epidemic has been going on for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And has more recently taken the limelight because it has affected more and more upper middle class and upper class white youth and adults. I think that it's getting more attention, but it's been a problem for many, many years. And I think that there's also, it's important for us to recognize that when somebody starts using even a pain med for an injury, like you mentioned, that can trigger this substance use disorder and can lead to somebody experimenting with other opioids or even being desperate for it when doctors decide that they need to be cut off from it. We have a researcher here at UT, Jane Maxwell, who researches trends in drug use. The other thing that we want to note is that heroin, you know, people conjure up the image of a needle in the arm almost mm-hmm. immediately, but heroin can come in powder form. Black tar heroin comes in a sticky substance that gets mixed with water, sometimes ingested, sometimes smoked. So there are lots of ways that people can use it. In fact, there's some forms of heroin that look exactly like cocaine. And so it takes some of that fear around using away for some youth that have been using other substances. So it's important to recognize that we're not just talking about pain meds or IV drug use. There's mm-hmm. a lot of versions in between.
And by the same token, since it has reached into that more middle class, upper middle class echelons. It's kind of a double-edged sword, right? I mean, on one hand, that echelon was very reluctant to acknowledge what was going on for a very long time, and on the other hand, that echelon is also has the resources to actually do something about it.
This
right?
is true. I mean, we're really it is a time for us to really put our reins around these wild horses and really take advantage of the opportunities. I also want to mention that this very afternoon, the Surgeon General's report on addiction is being rolled out, and there you can even tune in for a live stream of the event, which is taking place in Los Angeles today from 4 to 7:20 Eastern time. So if you get on the HazeldenBettyFord.org website, they're going to be streaming it live. So we'll get to hear about the Surgeon General's take on this. I think that we're starting through agencies and organizations like Facing Addiction, which is a national agency getting the word out, and actually had a rally last year with 35,000 folks showing up on the mall in D.C. People are starting to break down the stigma and recognize that this is a medical illness that needs treatment. And also, the way that we've framed treatment has been problematic for several years. We've treated it as if it's acute care, so someone comes in as if they can get fixed and then sent home to their regular environment. The truth is, like diabetes, this is a chronic and potentially fatal disease that actually takes years to fully recover from, and it takes tremendous amounts of support. So I want to say that while rehab is one option, it's not what everyone needs. There are some people that need community support and peer-to-peer support. There are some people that might find a recovery school and alternative peer groups as a useful setting for them. So we're changing it from this perception of acute care and a linear continuum of care to this sense that it is a chronic ongoing illness that needs sort of a holding environment of care or a safety net, so to speak, where agencies join together as networks and protect and intervene as the needs arise for different individuals.
We're talking about drug addiction in youth and strategies to reconcile their lives in the wake of some kind of rehabilitation, and at whatever form that might take, it's changing. You just heard Professor Lori Halloran-Steiker describe how it's changing with the times and with our knowledge base. She is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin School of Social Work, the author of the book Youth and Substance Use, Prevention, Intervention, and Recovery. Coming up, we're going to talk about these sober schools, safer environments, more strategically therapeutic environments for teens and young people with addiction problems. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Yale School of Medicine reports that opioid overdoses among children has nearly tripled from 1997 to 2012. It's now a crisis in many communities, and finding the proper treatment is hard enough, but without a systemic change, returning to high school means returning to the patterns that led to the addiction. Some states like Texas, Massachusetts, Indiana, and others have opened what they call sober high schools, and there's an effort afoot to do the same in Columbus. Still with us by phone from the University of Texas at Austin School of Social Work is Professor Lori Halloran-Steiker. She is the co-founder of Austin's first recovery high school. And joining us now is program manager for the Collegiate Recovery Community at Ohio State University, Sarah Nerad. She's also a member of the Columbus Recovery High School Initiative. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
What's the tipping point for making a sober high school a priority, do you think, Sarah Nerad?
Yeah, I think here in Central Ohio, we've noticed that there's really not a lot for our adolescents and young adults that are in or seeking recovery from a substance use disorder. And, you know, being a young person that came from Houston, it's kind of like the mecca of youth recovery. When I moved here, I was like, where are all the young people at? What do we have for them? And so over time, we've identified all these young people that return from treatment. We started having parents reaching out. What do I do with my young person now that we're back home? And so I think that tipping point was a lot of parents and young people saying, what's next after treatment for me back home?
Are there enough to fill a high school?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And how many are you thinking would be in a high school like this? I'm trying to give people some kind of visualization of what we're talking about.
Right. So the recovery high schools across the country vary in size, and they tend to fluctuate throughout the year, just given the nature of substance use disorders and young people. But some of the bigger ones have 100 students in them. So they will be smaller. We're talking young people in high school that recognize they have a substance use disorder and get into recovery. So that's already kind of a small cohort. But we're, you know, the effort we have here, we're hoping to open up with 25.
Professor Halloran-Steiker, I've used a couple terms here now. I've used the term recovery high school and also sober high school. Do they mean the same thing? What are we talking about?
Those terms are used interchangeably. I think that it's important for people to know that there have been sober high schools since the mid-80s, and there have been more sober high schools than are standing right now. It takes a lot to really lay the foundation and the groundwork for a successful recovery high school. And I think the most important piece is that the community take ownership of the recovery high school. We know that some of the schools that have more difficulty filling seats, it's because the community doesn't have a full understanding of what it's about. They may hold a lot of stigma attached to it. Even being a sober school or a recovery high school that's a UT charter school, University of Texas Charter School, we have parents that are worried that it's going to label their child or somehow disrupt their academic trajectory. So it's really important for people to know that these are settings that are incredibly positive for youth, that there are safe, sober, scholastic ways of addressing education and concurrently providing recovery support to youth. There are about 35 recovery schools in the nation right now, and probably another 10 or a dozen that are in formation phases. And there's lots of different kinds. There are some that are attached to treatment centers. There are some like ours that are charter schools. Some are private schools. Others are more linked to state resources like the Lesniak School in New Jersey. So I think it's a very important thing to note that they may look very different, but what they have in common is that youth who have substance use disorders can be provided with positive peer environments, recovery support services, and solid academics that help them to move towards their goals.
Is there any kind of sense, though, and as Sarah Nirad chime in, I mean, that it should be a public school issue so that there's some sort of consistency in terms of outreach?
Well, my experience real quick, and then I'll turn over to Sarah because I'm sure she's had unique experiences with this as well, is that we know that our public schools sometimes don't have the resources or the ability to attend to the intensive needs of youth in early recovery. So what we've done is we've partnered up with the independent school districts. In fact, on our board of University High School, we have the past superintendent of Eanes Independent School District, a very resourced school district, and also the past president of the school board for Austin Independent School District. And it's our goal that we become another option for youth that are not able to fare well in the present public school system.
And Sarah, you attended a recovery school in Houston. That's how you became acquainted with all of this in the first place, right?
Somewhat. So I didn't actually attend the recovery high school, but all my friends did. I did get into recovery when I was in high school and was able to transfer to an alternative school that kind of worked just the same for me as a recovery high school would, but I didn't actually go to one.
Okay.
But I, you know, what I've learned is that these schools can come all different models. I think it really depends on each community and kind of who is in that community that would be willing to support this and champion it. And I think, you know, here in Central Ohio, we want to pick a school model that's going to last over time. So it won't be tied to a certain superintendent or, you know, certain leaders. We want it to stand the test of time and be sustainable.
And how does that work? What have you found? What are you working on then?
Yeah, so we've been consulting with folks at the Department of Education and the surrounding local school districts. We're really looking at a charter school because given that it's going to be a smaller school, we can't limit it to just one school district. Mm-hmm. We need kids to be able to come from all of the surrounding schools and be able to come to it in a charter. And we also don't want them to have to pay tuition. I mean, treatment is expensive. So these families a lot of times have paid so much money already. So we want an affordable and accessible school option for these students.
And it's important, I'm going to add to what Sarah said. She's answered the question beautifully, and I want to add that in terms of sustainability, you have to be very creative. So we have partnered with the charter school component is our 501c3 nonprofit, which is the recovery support component. And so we do get donations. We do apply for grants. But one of the things that we're finding very useful is that the Texas model is one where the recovery high school supports and is supported by these alternative peer groups, which are essentially like expanded after-school programs for sober youth, if that makes sense. So they go from 8 to 3 to our sober high school, but then afterwards, it's actually mandatory in our system that they attend one of these alternative peer groups where they have recreational activities, social activities. They do homework together. They have some of them are more clinical than others, so they may have individual therapy and group therapy. They have family involvement. They have evening activities and weekend activities and even recreation trips in the summer. So the goal is sort of to wrap around the youth, like the old wraparound services in mental health systems, so that they can get everything they need both in and out of school. So we do a lot of connecting with community peer agencies, the 12-step communities, the like Sarah was talking about, the state resources, and we try to connect with other recovery schools. We consider Archway in Houston our sister school so that the kids can get together for example, SPROM, which is a sober prom. They all went together to the rally in D.C., and they also participated at the White House in an advocacy day. So there's a lot that that recovery schools do together, and I think it's important to mention that there is an association of recovery schools, and they provide incredible support and resources for the recovery schools. And if you're a new school, I do recommend their accreditation requirements because they make great blueprints for designing a school in terms of what's needed to have a successful school.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about youth addiction services and how they fit into a paradigm that includes what we're talking about now, recovery high schools, sober high schools. You just heard from Professor Lori Halloran-Steiker. She is a professor at the University of Texas Austin School of Social Work. Also with us, Sarah Nerad, program manager for the Ohio State University Collegiate Recovery Community. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It would be interesting to hear from people who are, you know, parents of youth who have been addicted or are addicted, and what their experience has been in a traditional high school coming out of recovery, coming out of rehabilitation, I should say. If you have a question or comment, again, 614-292-8513. Sarah, you said you did not attend a recovery school in Houston, but you had lots of friends who did.
Right.
Why didn't you?
Yeah, so Lori was mentioning these alternative peer groups, which are so key to all of this. So the recovery high school in Houston requires that you be a part of an alternative peer group, which now, you know, as someone helping start this, I'm like, that makes so much sense. That's a good move. But at the time I was entering recovery, I didn't want to be in the APG. I just wanted to kind of go on, live my life. And, you know, I've always been a little too cool for school. So I kind of struggled to fit in there with all the other young people. And you know, that's what worked for me. But all of my friends benefited from that, you know, having a normative youth experience, right? Getting to stay up late, hang out with friends, go camping, like just hang out at a coffee shop. And, you know, I was, when I entered recovery, I was like, I need to take more college classes. I need to get a job. And I was, you know, 17 going on 40.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that sound familiar to you, Professor Halloran-Steiker?
Important. I think Sarah makes a great point. Recovery schools are not for everyone. There are some youth that won't find it a conducive environment or that may want other things out of their high school experience. I mean, for example, very few recovery high schools, if any, have sports programs.
Right.
And so there are some things that may not be a fit. But many of the youth that come to us are very, very desperate. They say that they have tried on numerous occasions to return to their high school and that they're unable to stay clean and sober if someone were to be there to offer them a substance, or as soon as they're triggered by their old peer groups, that is just too immense for them to overcome. So it is definitely not for everyone, but our experience is that when youth and families come to do a tour of the school, they come to visit, they meet with the executive director, Julie McElrath, who's an extraordinary individual, a great community connector, and very, very keen to the power of this disease. She has actually children in recovery herself. I think that once, if they are a fit for the school, when they come there, it's not what they expect. They think that it's going to be more rigid. They think that there's going to that'll have a punitive sense. And what it really is based in is love and support. Enthusiastic recovery is the initial model from the 70s that we still utilize. It's our take that if a young person is not having more fun in their sobriety than they had when they were using, there's no way we're going to tip that decisional balance scale. So I would say, you know, while it's not for everyone, that if any parent out there is listening and they have access to a recovery school, go check it out and go see what's happening there, because I don't know if people have accurate pictures of what happens in recovery schools.
How do you measure success at the recovery school, at University High School?
It's a great question. We actually do have research protocols in place with an IRB so that we do gather information so that we can see what's working and what's not and really help other schools as they're forming. That's one of the benefits of being connected with the University of Texas. We also have interns that can help with that. But we don't just measure on the basis of when's your sobriety date and how long have you been clean and sober, because that's problematic. I think that, you know, we put too much emphasis on sobriety date, and then we're going to lose the fact that for a lot of young people, because it hasn't totally consumed their lifetime because they're so young, they need the experience of hearing all of the potential risks and sometimes feeling into it, sometimes even having a recurrence of use, and then getting back on and saying, wait, that means that I really do fit this description. I really do need to do more of those things. So it's important to know that that's sometimes par for the course. So we also utilize things like quality of life measures. We utilize a measurement instrument that was originally designed with William White. If anybody wants to look it up, they can. It's called the Recovery Capital Scale. And what really we're looking at is, are they gaining the capacity to live really functional, joyous, connected, well lives, as opposed to how they were living before they came to the school?
And Sira Nirad, you're nodding when we're talking about if you're happier, you have to be happier sober than you were using. And how did that feel to you? I mean, physically, because there's a physical addiction. We've talked about the neurological addiction, the brain change.
Absolutely. I remember, you know, right when I was getting out of treatment and just starting to go around the recovery community, people tell me it's going to get different and then it's going to get really good. And I mean, they made recovery cool, you know, where I was living, to where I saw these really cool young people that were having fun. And so I remember coming in and seeing all these other young people and thinking, maybe this isn't going to be the worst thing ever. You know, maybe I will be able to have fun. Maybe I will be able to go to prom. Maybe boys are going to still want to date me. And when you're, you know, in high school, those are the things you care about. And am I going to be liked, accepted? What am I going to do for fun?
And being a partier.
Yeah, I needed
that
community. Uh-huh. And, you know, so having a really strong youth recovery community kind of made that transition so much easier for me. Not that recovery's ever, you know, like an easy thing, but it was enticing. It was cool. I wanted what these young people had.
Did it matter what you were addicted to?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
So whether it was methamphetamines or whether it was opioids or marijuana, whatever it was.
If you identified as, you know, being in recovery and you were, you know, abstinent from drugs and alcohol, you were in. You were in.
We're going to continue our conversation. That's Sira Nirad. She's program manager for the Ohio State University Collegiate Recovery Community. We want to talk about, you know, how you transition then into college as well. Also with us, Lori Halloran-Steiker. She's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin School of Social Work and author of the book Youth and Substance Use, Prevention, Intervention, and Recovery. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For school-aged youth, addiction rehabilitation sometimes requires dropping out of school for a 60 or 90-day stint in a clinic. Youth now make up as much as 12% of admissions to already stressed, publicly funded rehab facilities. About half of those children who return from rehab to reenter traditional school relapse within a year. Several states have opened recovery or sober high schools to reverse that dynamic. Still with us by phone is professor at the University of Texas at Austin School of Social Work, Dr. Lori Halloran-Steiker. She's the co-founder of University High School, Austin's first recovery high school. Also, with us, program manager for the Collegiate Recovery Community at OSU, Sarah Nerad. Sarah is with the Columbus Recovery High School Initiative. And thanks again to both of you for joining us. If anyone has a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. These are real high schools, right, with diplomas, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and what kind of feedback have you received from colleges, universities, and so forth about the quality of the student coming out of them?
Well, initially recovery high schools used to be thought of as sort of dropout prevention, but there are more and more mechanisms now that allow them to really pave the foundation to higher education. University high school especially focuses on that. And one of the mechanisms that we find very useful is having the collegiate recovery program youth and our drug and alcohol peer advisors who are undergraduates doing mentorship and tutoring programs in the school itself so that the young people in recovery at the high school see what it looks like to be a sober person that is enjoying the college realm, even though some people would consider colleges to be sobriety hostile. They get to witness a sober tailgate, other students studying to be addictions counselors themselves. And many of the recovery schools now have very high rates of youth transitioning to college directly out of school. I think that Sasha McLean, who's the director at Archway Academy in Houston, said something like 94% of their youth graduates, and there were over 70 graduates, were going to college that year.
So collegiate recovery community is a thing at lots of universities, not just at OSU, right, Sarah? Right?
Yeah, there's about 200 across the country.
Tell us what you do at OSU.
Absolutely. So the Collegiate Recovery Community is a program of the Student Life Student Wellness Center, and we are a positive peer community as well as academic and recovery support services for students in recovery from alcohol and drug addiction. So we have everything from recovery housing to recovery scholarships, peer-to-peer support, the sober tailgates that Lori mentioned, a space on campus where they can come together throughout the day and hang out. It's just a really strong community with some programming to ensure that they, you know, are successful in all areas of their life.
And about how many students in any given year are in and out at that operation?
Yeah, I would say about every year there's about 50 students that we have interactions with. Right now we've got about 18 official members of our program, and we'll graduate some, we'll accept some more. And then there's students that come that kind of utilize us as they see fit, or they're kind of just dipping their toe into the recovery waters to see if that's for them. So we're pretty open to any student wanting to explore.
Any sense, Lori Halloran-Steiker, about how many kids at a university like Ohio State have addiction issues?
Well, they say that about 4 in 10 would have some issue related to substances, and that about 1 in 10 would have the full-blown disrupted pleasure pathway, brain disease, with a substance use disorder either occurring or in the process of occurring. So, but then there are opportunities to intervene, like I teach a young people in drugs class, and so that would be a higher number of collegiate students who would be apt to be misusing substances, because we suppose it's one of the reasons they get attracted to the course in the first place, because they want to learn more about it. So,
and see how they fit into it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Rob in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Rob.
How's it going? I just wanted to ask, So with alcohol,
hey, Rob, could I interrupt you for just a second? You're very muffled.
Yes. I apologize.
Is that better? Can you?
Is this better?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Okay. So with alcohol and drug use as prominent on college campuses as it is, how do these recovery high schools prepare these students for the transition into a potentially hostile college environment?
Dr. Halloran Steiker, you want to take a swat at that one?
Sure, and I'm sure Sarah will want to add to it. But I think it's a matter of knowing where those safe spaces are and how to have peers who are like-minded and like-spirited in your recovery. So I think that centers for collegiate recovery, like our CSR, Center for Students in Recovery, are a real haven for these students. I think more and more colleges are setting up not just sober dorms, but there's sober housing off campus. Most of us really work very hard in the community surrounding the college to make sure that they know that there are porous boundaries to the 40 acres so that they can step outside of the university when they need to get further support. So I think that there's a lot of mechanisms for support on a college campus. And I think that more and more people are looking for a college that has a collegiate recovery program if they're a young person in recovery.
Sarah, what was your experience? I mean, you said as soon as you were out of recovery or when you were working in recovery or in recovery, right, you started wanting to enroll in college courses. You were 17 years old. That's not typical, is it?
Probably not. Okay. I think for me, it was I just didn't fit in. I was 17 years old. I was a junior in high school. All my peers were just starting to really use. And I had already, you know, realized I had a problem
been
and needed
there, done
to
that.
Stop.
Yeah.
And so for me, what was best for my recovery was graduating early and really working towards building up my life. So I went to the community college and I had a job and then got to go to meetings and be in recovery.
And when you did you end up going to a traditional four-year college?
I did. And when I graduated high school, we actually decided not to go off to a major university because I was so worried, you know, who am I going to hang out with? What if someone in my, you know, my dorm is using? And so I chose to
what
stay
if my
at
roommate's
home.
Using?
Exactly. Yeah. And stay where my network was. And I ended up transferring to Texas Tech because they had a collegiate recovery program. So I chose that school because they had that program.
Huh. Okay. Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Beth.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. Thanks.
Good. I was calling to give a shout out for the CRC. I am a member and heard that Sarah was on, and I just love the CRC.
Are you a member when you say that? Are you a student at Ohio State?
I am a student. I'm a non-traditional, and that's one of the reasons I chose Ohio State, too, was because of the CRC and the sober community.
It makes sense that there's probably a fair number of non-traditional students, Sarah, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's our majority. Average age is 26.
Okay. All right. Been there. I've been around the block 26. A few times by the time you get to college, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
What do you like about it, Beth? What works for you in CRC?
Well, I'm here right now, and it's just a safe place for me to come on campus. And we have computers, and I can print, and I'm sitting up here writing papers. And
people know that if you're in there, you're in there because.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they do. And so it's just a great place, and the people are amazing. The community is amazing. It just makes my whole experience at Ohio State, I just can't even tell you.
Okay.
It means so much.
Well, thank you so much for calling, and best wishes for every success at OSU.
Thank you.
Thanks, Beth.
Thanks.
And can I jump in for a second?
Sure, yeah.
I love hearing Beth's response to it, and I hear it a lot from our students, be they undergraduates or graduate students. I wanted to say that the collegiate recovery programs, while they tend to be somewhat around the size that that Sarah mentioned, that there's tremendous support even among university administrations these days. Our regents were so excited about having the Collegiate Recovery Program, the CSR, the Center for students in recovery. They were so excited about the efficacy of this model on the UT Austin campus that they decided to disseminate the model to all 9 UT campuses. So I think that it's important for people to know that that if they don't have a collegiate recovery program at their school, that it can start with a sponsored student group. It can grow into something more definitive, something with its own designated space. But there's an agency called Transforming Youth Recovery that can be of great assistance if there's a college or some students saying, gee, we don't have one of those at our school and we'd like to start one. That's a great resource.
Debbie in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I'm so glad to hear about this show because I have a friend whose teenage child is just struggling with this now in their early 20s, in and out of rehab. But is there any spiritual component to these schools, to this recovery?
I suppose it depends, but Sarah Nerad, what's your experience?
Yeah, I mean, just this morning, our students at the Collegiate Recovery Community here at Ohio State did a Buddhist meditation. So I think, you know, spirituality is a key component of recovery. So I think it's important that we let our students kind of explore that and learn different ways that they can bring that into their daily life and their daily practice.
But it's not necessarily a Christian thrust.
Exactly.
Or, you know, there's not a denomination or anything
Correct.
Like that associated with it. Is that what you were getting at, Debbie?
I think so. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Lori Halloran-Steiker, is this something, I mean, what kind of questions should a parent or a person, you know, who's in recovery ask about any of this kind of stuff? What should they be asking when they're looking for a school or looking for a program?
Yeah, I think that it's important to recognize, you know, first of all, I think it's really, really critical to note that very few youth come to these schools and say, oh, I can't wait to go to a recovery high school. It's always a decision that involves some ambivalence. So that's why I really recommend going and visiting and having the experience of sitting there and getting a tour from some of the kids and feeling into the milieu. There's a tremendous supportive environment with love and nurturing. And I think that if someone really is amenable to help, that they'll have more of a likelihood of getting enrolled in the school if they actually visit. I think it's important for parents to know that if their young person has, for example, tried to stop using on several occasions, that's usually a pretty good indicator that a special school might be a really good option. Because I think that, you know, many kids are using, there may be kids that are misusing, but kids that are unable to stop when they try to stop is really sort of the population that we aim at for recovery high schools.
I imagine, Sarah Nerad, that Ohio State gets thousands, hundreds if not thousands, of visitors every year just to see if they want to go to school there, right?
Right.
People who just drop by and visit. Do you get a lot of those kind of visitors in your office?
We do. And we've even had high schoolers come and visit us.
That's
and,
what I mean, like kids
yeah.
looking for a, yeah.
Absolutely. Not as many as the, you know, non-traditional students
okay.
that we serve, but we have had them.
Yeah. Okay. Sarah Nerad, what's your recommendation for people who have questions? You know, what kind of questions should they be asking? You agree with having the visiting and actually seeing what it's like. Any other quick suggestions?
Yeah, go and visit and come and hang out. You know, spend some time meeting the community of young people to make sure it's a good fit because there are a lot of options, at least with the college program. So you want to be at a school that fits both your recovery and your academic needs.
Okay.
Can I also say, Anne, that in terms of sustainability, most of the recovery high schools that I know would never turn a youth away, even if they did not have the resources to participate, because different schools have different what they call program costs or whatever. I think it's important that people know that this is not something that is just for one group of youth, that they're very diverse schools in different areas and diverse alternative peer groups are popping up. So I think that's an important piece. Don't let money be a reason not to go.
I'll just end this note on an email from Michael. He says, I was listening today, and I think that sober schools are an awesome idea and hope to see them more prevalent across the state. I personally had issues in high school and started out unsuccessfully at OSU in 2010, dropping out after two quarters. I have since made my way back, and I'm doing great now as a junior, but if I could have spent some time in a sober high school when my problems first arose, maybe I never would have had to go through college failure to turn my life around. Thank you, Michael, for that email. Thanks, Sarah Nerad from the Ohio State University Collegiate Recovery Community. And also Lori Halloran-Steiker, professor at University of Texas at Austin School of Social Work and author of Youth and Substance Use, Prevention, Intervention, and Recovery. Thanks to both of you, and thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.